Story is told of a battleship that was on a dark sea, trying to navigate, had lost some of their navigation equipment, and they were trying to make their way to safety, and there was a bright light in front of them. And the captain of the ship got on the communication system and got a hold of whoever would respond to this bright light and said, "Whoever you are, I'm a captain of a battleship. You need to move 20 degrees out of our direction." And the response came back and said, "Sir, you need to move 20 degrees." And the captain was furious and he responded back. He said, "Listen, I am the captain of a battleship. You need to move. You have to shift the direction 20 degrees. And the response came, "Sir, I'm a lowly officer, but I'm telling you, you need to move 20 degrees. The captain said, "Okay, I cannot do this." He said, "Sir, listen," he said, "I'm telling you for the last time, you need to adjust course 20 degrees. I am a battleship." And the response came, "Well, sir, you have to understand, I am a lighthouse. You decide." We live in a world that is a dark world. We live in a world that is trying to light its own way, if at all possible, or a world that is trying to get us to adjust our course, trying to get us to change the direction that we live, trying to get us to change how we approach the world around us. We're in an ever-present battle between good and evil. And we are in that world. We are called, we are charged by Jesus to let His light shine to the world around us. And that is a difficult task. It's a task that is sometimes unwelcome. It is, as I've just said, it's a task that sometimes the world tries to get us to divert from, get us to go a different direction and to think things differently. But the absolute answer is, whether the world wants to hear it or not, we have the same perspective as that lighthouse. We want what is best for the world around us. And the thing that we can do best for them is to direct them out of sin, out of darkness, and to the light that is Jesus Christ. This morning, I want us to look a little further at this idea of shining the light of Jesus into the dark world. And as we look at this idea of shining the light of Jesus, I want us to look at Mark chapter 5. And we'll look at the first several verses of that chapter. See, we need to see the light that we shine into the world is Jesus Christ. The world needs that light. Sometimes the world doesn't want to realize they need that light. And we need to understand that we need to have confidence that the light that is Jesus Christ can really change the world. We need to believe that. And we need to realize that we have also, no matter what our situation is before we came to Christ, no matter how good of an individual we were, no matter where we were, no matter how bad we were, when we came to Christ and we were immersed into Jesus and we had our sins washed away and we became a child of God, as these two that were mentioned this morning have just done, that we have a responsibility to let the world know what God has done for us. That we have a responsibility to let that light shine in a world that, again, may not be crazy about it, but a world that needs to know who Jesus is. Even if they don't want to know, even if the world doesn't appreciate what we do, we will shine for Jesus anyway. So let's look together at Mark chapter 5. Let's look at the first few verses here. And what I believe that we can see here is that without Jesus, the world is indeed a dark place. Let's look at verses 1 through 5. "They came to the other side of the sea in the region of the Gerasenes. As soon as he got out of the boat, a man with an unclean spirit came out of the tombs and met him. He lived in the tombs, and no one was able to restrain him anymore, not even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but had torn the chains apart and had smashed through his shackles. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones." What we see right off the bat is a pathetic, sad picture. Jesus is greeted by a man who is possessed with a demon. Now, I'm not going to attempt to get into trying to explain or even understand how that worked in Jesus' day. It just did. But what we do know is that these forces of evil ultimately are forces of sin and Satan. So in some way or another, this is the responsibility of Satan. That this is a man who has, for whatever reason, however that worked, we don't get. But this is a man whose life is miserable. He's insane. He roams these hillsides. He roams this area screaming at night. It says he cuts himself. He's doing all this stuff. And no matter what he does, he is powerless to change this situation. And again, I don't know how this happened. I don't know why this happened. That's one of those things I will openly tell you. I just do not understand. But what we do know is the people around him did know. Or at least they knew about him. They knew this situation with this guy. It says that he couldn't be chained anymore, which tells us that they had tried to do something. And it seems as though they have taken him and stationed him or tried to chain him up outside the city. Because like them, like a lot of people in our society, sometimes when we have problems like this, the best thing we can do is get them away from us. Put them somewhere where we don't have to see it, don't have to deal with it. And this is apparently what the people did. But even no matter what the people had done, the people had taken their own action. The people had done what they could. Still powerless. The man was still in the same state no matter what the people tried to do. Right off the bat here, I want to make a comparison for us to see this man engulfed in this evil, in dealing with this demon in his life. Seems a whole lot like the world around us. The world around us is engulfed in evil. The world around us is embracing and welcoming sin. And people all around us are trying to solve problems that they can't solve. Looking to each other, looking to the solutions of the world, looking to the solutions that they create on the... These are problems people can't solve. Because the problem ultimately, in many, many cases, is the problem is sin. And people aren't going to be able to solve that problem on their own. As I mentioned in class just a couple of weeks ago, we finished up our teen camp. And I speak at our teen camp, and I'm also one of the co-directors. And we're very excited about our camp and what we're doing at camp. We had 141 campers from 7th through 12th grade this year, from 9 states, which was really cool for us. And we had one young man who'd come from Missouri, and it was the first time he'd ever been to camp. I mean, he grew up in a Christian home, but had never really quite pulled the trigger on going to camp. And he loved it. He had a great week. He left excited. We spent the whole week talking about, we taught through the Gospel of John. And it came up to me 2 or 3 times, said, I never heard that. I never thought about that. And the kid was excited, and he left camp and they had a 73-hour drive, whatever it was, a very long drive to get home. But he was all excited. In fact, the guy that brought him texted me about halfway through and said, I can't get Eli to shut up because he just keeps going on and keeps going on. But at one point on the way home, he got a text from home and said, whenever you get a chance, call. The young man called home and found out that one of his siblings who the family knew had been involved in drugs. This sibling of this young man had just gone too far and taken it too far and had taken his own life. And that's what the young man had to go home to. A situation that his family had tried to help, the church there had tried to help, but the sibling of his was too far. Had embraced this lifestyle way too much. And the guilt of it and the struggle with it became too much for him. And the family was devastated. And they were heartbroken. And we see those stories all around us. Where because of sin, because of some sort of evil that has gotten into people's lives, some sort of situation that has happened, where evil is winning. According to worldometers.info, according to their statistics, there's 26 million abortions every year. Yet there's also 55 million children abandoned every year. Depression is on the verge of being considered our new pandemic we have to deal with. Hospitals are overflowing with people, not with physical diseases, but with mental struggles, with anxiety and depression. Suicide is skyrocketing in our culture. 55 million Americans apparently are on antidepressants. It doesn't take much to watch any sort of news and see that there's just so much in the world that is wrong, that it's hard to deal with. And we look at the world that we live in, and honestly, the truth is, I mean, our political leaders, our governmental leaders, they're powerless to change some of this. I've heard it said before that you cannot legislate morality. You can't make people be good people. And yes, some of that is, I mean, there are medical situations and things like that that we have to deal with as a society. But the truth is, so many of our problems are caused by sin, caused by darkness that we've allowed to just enter into our culture. And not just our culture, it's all over the world. I'm not saying America is any better or any worse than anybody else. It's just what we know, right? But it's a dark world. And there's no question that we can see it in our schools. We can see it in our workplaces. We can see it, sadly, sometimes in our own families. That there's a darkness that we have to deal with. But you know what the world needs? Well, the answer to that is yes, you do know what the world needs. Isaiah said it like this in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, said the people walking in darkness have seen a great light, in this prophecy pointing, of course, toward Jesus. That's what the world needs. When this man, it's so interesting, we'll talk about this in a second, but it's so interesting, when Jesus pulls up on this shore, this man is right there ready to go. He's ready to talk to Jesus immediately. Darkness, whether it knows it or not, people in darkness need Jesus. And whether they know it or not, we know it, right? We know that the world needs to know who Jesus is. And even though it's a challenge, we also have to realize that the light of Christ can overcome darkness. The light of Jesus Christ can take care of the darkness in the world. Let's keep reading. Let's start at verse 6 here in chapter 5. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and knelt before him. As soon as he sees Jesus, the man gets there. And he cried out with a loud voice, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you before God, don't torment me." For he had already told him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." "What is your name?" he asked him. "My name is Legion," he answered, "because we are many." That's one of those scenes. You know, there's so many scenes in the Bible that I don't know how it's going to work, but I hope in heaven we get to see some of this stuff. I want to see the Red Sea parting. I want to see Elijah on Mount Carmel. This is one I want to see. I always imagine a creepy, scary voice with this guy. Maybe it's too many movies. I don't know. But he said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the region. A large herd of pigs was there feeding on the hillside. The demons begged him, "Send us into the pigs so that we may enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. The herd of about 2,000 rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned there. I said, that's kind of a bizarre setting. But what we see is that immediately the man comes to Jesus. Now, I want to talk about a couple of things here that I think are pretty interesting that we need to be aware of that are maybe kind of side topics with this, but I think we have to look at it here. Number one, how did this guy know who Jesus was? I mean, the man's apparently so crazy that people don't even go around him. But evil understood who God is. Even this man possessed with this demon understood. He calls him the Son of the Most High God. You think Satan doesn't understand who God is? But this also tells us something about Satan. When this guy shows up, he has a plan. What this tells us is that Satan is intelligent. Evil has the ability to organize. I think we have been done a disservice, at least my generation was done a disservice, by armor deviled ham. If you're near my, you know what I'm talking about. Armor deviled ham had the little bitty little can with a little white wrapper that had the little devil on it with a little pitchfork and a little pointy tail. And I think that's the image we get of Satan, that he's a little cartoon character. That, you know, or maybe you watch too many Looney Tunes and it's always sitting a little cartoon character sitting on your shoulder. That is not who Satan is. Peter tells us that he's like a roaring lion prowling about seeking whom he may devour. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 2:11 that we need not be ignorant of his schemes. Satan has a plan, which tells us we have to be prepared. This man was prepared for Jesus. Whatever this thing, however this worked, as it says immediately, the word Mark uses so often, immediately, this man came to Jesus. So Satan has intelligence. Satan has a plan, but this also tells us something about Satan here, that Satan is always working to oppose Jesus. We don't really know what the situation here was, but it doesn't seem like Jesus' intent was to get to this, wherever he was on this side of the sea, and deal with this man immediately. But this man's plan was to be there immediately. Satan is always going to work to oppose Jesus. We've dealt with this in so many different things over the years. Last year, you all dealt with the same thing here. Yours happened at camp, right before our camp last year. We had an outbreak of COVID that we were trying to figure out, do we have camp? Do we not have camp? What do? We put in all these sanitation things, and our staff reports Saturday to camp. Friday night, I'm on the phone with our camp board directors, and at 11 o'clock, we finally decide, okay, we've already got people coming from out of state. We've got to just pull the trigger and just pray God takes care of us. We had 16 baptisms at camp. Satan was working to oppose us. Satan planted those seeds of doubt. Yes, I get it. COVID is whatever it is. But because of that, we were reacting in a way the world wanted us to react, in a way that Satan wanted us to react. We were backing away, but we went ahead. And 16 new Christians. And I don't know, I feel like I have to say this to defend myself. You know what camp baptisms are sometimes, where you have the kids get too excited and just kind of get caught up in the flow? 15 of those 16 kids were back at camp and are faithful for a year. For a teenager, man, that's so great. But Satan didn't want us to do that. You guys have dealt with that. I'm sure you've dealt with planning things and planning events, and something comes up and somebody has a doubt and somebody doesn't want to do it because Satan doesn't want us to succeed. Satan doesn't want the light of Jesus to impact the world that he is in control of. Satan will always work to oppose Jesus. Now, when we think about this, if we fast forward, we have to think about what happens here. It seems sometimes that evil always wins. Sometimes it seems like the bad people always get ahead. And really, even in this situation, if we fast forward, what Satan was trying to do, what this demon, whatever it is, was trying to do, is to get Jesus to leave. And he does. Jesus leaves the area. And I wonder sometimes, kind of like I wonder about the crucifixion. I wonder if in this moment Satan thought he'd won a little victory. If at this point Satan's like, all right, I ran him out of this area, I'll get him in the next place. It's like on the cross. You know, when Jesus dies on the cross, I don't believe Satan knew what was coming. I think Satan probably thought for 3 days things were just great. That he came to earth, his own people rejected him, and they killed him. And then that tomb came open. And things changed for Satan. But in this scene, the point is to try and get Jesus to leave this area, and Jesus does leave. Again, this is a battle between good and evil. This demon, when Jesus asks its name, he says, our name is Legion because we are many. The Legion is a division of the Roman army. Some people say the man could have had thousands of demons in him. We don't know. I mean, we don't know if it's 3,000, we don't know if it's 5,000, 10,000. That's a great theological debate that, you know, scholars talk about. I'm going to tell you the answer. So be ready. I'm going to tell you the answer. How many demons the guy had? It does not matter. It doesn't matter how many demons there. It doesn't matter how possessed, if that's even a term, how possessed this guy was, because Jesus wins. In one sentence, what Jesus said, in fact, Mark even says it in kind of passing, kind of how the Bible sometimes does sometimes, because it says that in verse 8, it says that Jesus had already told him one thing. Jesus said, get out. And that's all that mattered. And we need to remember that. It doesn't matter how strong the evil in the world seems. It doesn't matter how prevalent sin seems in the world around us. Ultimately, Jesus will always win. Light will always overcome darkness. Philippians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11 tells us that at the end of time, every knee will bow to Jesus. Every knee, light will always win. Jesus will always win. Our world is full of respected people, well-known people, famous people who have written books, appear on podcasts and TV shows, who are so vehemently opposed to Jesus. Those people will bow the knee to Jesus. The Richard Dawkins, the Christopher Hitchens, all these guys who make a living opposing the light of Jesus, every knee will bow. Those who say that God is not real, those that say that Jesus was a fake, they will ultimately find out. Every knee will bow. Our government official, Joe Biden, will bow the knee someday. Donald Trump will bow the knee someday. Our parents, our bosses, our employees, eventually everyone will believe that Jesus is exactly who this demon said he was, Jesus, the Son of the Most High God. And we need to know that. And we need to believe that confidently when we are engaging in taking the light of Jesus to the world. The light that Jesus is can overcome your situation. Because you can't do it on, you can't overcome your addictions, you can't overcome your problems, you can't overcome your sin on your own, but you have Jesus on your side. And we need to remember that when we take the light of Jesus to the world. I'm a basketball fan. I really love college basketball. I kind of watch some NBA a little bit. I like some of the stories of the NBA. A few years ago, you might recall a young man that was a pretty decent basketball player that became kind of a hero because he grew up in this area, and then when he signed his NBA contract, he went and played for his local team. You might know this guy. He was really, really well. Everybody thought it was so great that he went and played back for the Cavaliers. He grew up in Akron or whatever. And he was a decent player. I'm a Jordan fan, obviously. LeBron's a pretty good player, I guess. But it was so cool. Everybody thought it was so great that he'd go play for the mediocre Cleveland Cavaliers. And then, as you may recall, after a few years of not winning, he decided to, in his terms, take his talents to South Beach. There's a big story, great big deal. Had his own TV show to switch teams. And then what happened? I mean, what exactly everybody thought was going to happen was he started winning. He came to a team that started winning. Four straight NBA championships, and two of them they won the title. But what we have to remember is it wasn't just him. He had a pretty good team around him. And one of those, Dwayne Wade, I think, was probably the cog in that wheel. But it wasn't just him. It was a big deal that he came to play for that team and join with those guys. But it wasn't just him. It was a team deal. Now, this is a really, really cheesy illustration, but here's a way that you can overcome the evil in the world around you. Join up with Jesus. That's what LeBron had to do. He couldn't win in Cleveland, so he had to go join up with these two guys. We have to remember that the way we overcome sin, the way that we deal with the sin around us, is we overcome by letting Jesus be our overcomer. Letting Jesus have control of our lives and letting the light of Jesus shine out, not just when we're wanting to represent Jesus in a positive way, but when we have to deal with struggles, when we have to deal with evil. That's what John says. Who is it that overcomes the world? The one who believes in Jesus. And as John uses the term believe, he's talking about that old great hymn that we sing. When John says believe, he means trust and obey. He doesn't mean mental assent. He means trust and obey. Believe in who Jesus is and do what he tells you to do. That's how you overcome. Amen. That's what the light that shines in the world really is all about. So Jesus runs these demons out of this man. And the man is healed. And the man, his countenance is better. The town rejoices. They hoist Jesus on their shoulders. And they parade him through town. There's confetti. And they name the street after it. And that's not what happens. None of that happens. Let's keep reading. What we'll see is that the reality is that sometimes people don't like it when the light shines around them. Let's look at verses 14 and 17 here. The men who tended them, the pigs, this is what we're talking about. The men who tended the pigs ran off and reported to the town and the countryside, and the people went to see what had happened. They came to see Jesus and saw the man who had been demon-possessed sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs. They're telling people about the pigs, not about this guy who's been demon-possessed and chained. They're telling people about the pigs. Then they begin to beg Jesus to leave their region. What would you expect these people to do? Just like what I said, right? You'd expect these people to rejoice. This man was a menace to their town. I'm sure that every kid in that town, you guys, when you were kids, for me, I grew up in Perry, Oklahoma. I could ride my bike anywhere, but at 3:30 I had to come home because we couldn't be near Ditch Witch, the Ditch Witch manufacturing facility in Perry, because that was where all the traffic in the 3,000 population town of Perry happened. There's areas you can't go. I bet this was an area parents told their kids, do not go near that mountain where that crazy dude is. Because you stay away from that guy. And that's over. The man is better. It says that he's dressed, he's sane, he's got his jacket and tie on, or I don't know what he has, but he's ready to go. You would think the people would be happy. They'd be so excited. They'd be impressed with what Jesus did. They'd be awestruck by the power of Jesus. They'd be glad their kids were safe. They'd be glad there wasn't some crazy guy screaming in the mountains anymore. You'd think they'd be glad that this man was right. But that wasn't their reaction. That wasn't what they wanted. They were afraid. They didn't want Jesus in their area. Why is that? Why were they afraid? Because people don't like it when change happens. People kind of like the status quo. And I'm telling you, in many, many ways, I am that person. My kids are still at home because they can't afford to move out yet, I guess. But I hope they don't ever see this. But I love having my kids at home. And one of our favorite things is, if we can ever get everybody in the house at the same time, is to sit and watch a movie together. But after all these years, sometimes my kids will sit where I sit. And it's like, what are you doing? And I'll come and I'll stand up by, I sit on this one end of the couch. And we have the little reclining couch thing. And one of my kids will sit there and I'll be like, what are you doing? When we first went to Meridian, when we first moved to Meridian, we were sitting about right here where this gentleman is with the yellow tie. And we just, you know, we sat there. It was first Sunday. We didn't know where to sit. And one thing I learned, be careful where you sit. And this guy who ended up becoming one of my very good friends, we're sitting there and he comes walking up and he stands right there at the end of the pew and he goes, and I was like, hi, person. And he goes, and then he laughed and it was fun. But I was like, people don't like change. That's where I sit. That's my end of the couch. That's our crazy guy in the mountains. We're used to it. That's how it is. Yes, it's a pain. It's kind of a nuisance. But that's how things are. We know we don't go there. We know Jesus came along and changed everything. So the people tell him to get out. Because people don't like it when light shows up where it's not expected. Seems like the people were, somebody was pretty upset about the pigs. 2,000 pigs would be a big deal. I get that. But we can't be so concerned about the pigs, we forget about the people. When I went to college, I went to Oklahoma State University. My freshman year, my best friend in Broken Arrow was supposed to come with me. And we were, I tell people sometimes, I wasn't always a preacher. We were not the best human beings. And he got into the trouble that we both should have gotten into, but he got caught and I didn't. But so he couldn't come our freshman first semester. So I was kind of bummed out that I didn't have him as my roommate because we'd had this plan forever. And so I kind of bounced around roommates. Well, then start of the second semester, Kirk was going to be able to come be my roommate, and we were all both excited. And then we move into the dorm room. You know, the dorm rooms are like the size of this table. You put two people and all their stuff in there. And Kirk was a much better student than I was. And he's an engineer of some sort now. But he had a class that was called metallurgy. If any of you know what that means, you're one step ahead of me, because I still to this day have no idea what that was. But it was a 7 o'clock class. And I thought, okay, he's got a 7 o'clock class, he'll do the right thing and skip it like you're supposed to. But no, he got up every morning, every other morning, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 7 o'clock. He'd get up about 6:48 because it was right down, go down these back stairs and across the parking lot. So it was right there. But he'd get up every morning and he'd get ready and he would turn the light on in the dorm room. I mean, there's no private little corner in a dorm room. And every morning I was like, Kirk, please shut the... And what was even worse is he'd hurry around and leave the light on. And I'm like, dude, it's the middle of the night. It's 7 o'clock in the morning. Like, what are you doing? I said, we don't like that, right? When somebody, when you're trying to stay in your own little darkness and somebody turns the light on, we don't want that. We like where we are. And it seems that that's where these people were. They were okay with this man. They were okay. And maybe it wasn't even that they were okay with this man, but maybe it was when they saw what Jesus did, when they saw the change that Jesus made in this man's life, their thought was, what's he going to want to change about me? What's he going to want to do to me? Because the world doesn't like that. The world sometimes isn't ready for that. The easiest solution is just shut the light out. We have to understand that when we shine the light of Jesus in people's lives, some people are going to reject us. Some people aren't ready for it. Some people don't want to hear it. And we have to be okay with that. Because we also have to remember that God says that His word does not go out and doesn't return back to Him void. That it's still worth it to plant the seeds. It's still worth it if even we're just scattering seeds. But sometimes people are just going to say no. And we have to be okay with that. That sometimes people don't want the light that we're going to shine. Which makes it hard for us. And I understand that. I get that. But we also have to understand, we also have to have confidence and know that the light of Jesus does change lives. The light of Jesus is what people need in their lives. The light of Jesus is what makes a difference in people. Look again at verses 15 through 17. As we notice this man, they came to Jesus, saw the man who had been demon-possessed, sitting there dressed in his right mind, and they were afraid, and they go and describe it, and they tell it to everybody else, and people are just dumbfounded that this guy, in fact, in Matthew's account, Matthew tells us the man was naked, that the man was running around without clothes, and now he's sitting there dressed and in his right mind. The man was insane, and now he's motivated. The man was a menace. And now he seems to know what he's doing. He seems to be ready to be a part of society. Jesus changed this man's life. I don't know. I don't know any other way to think about. I can't think of another illustration of Jesus changing a life more completely. I mean, yes, there's people that Jesus raised from the dead, which is pretty life-changing, but they seem like they were people that Jesus had a connection with or were children anyway. But you think of this guy think of the condition he's in. And with a word, Jesus changes it. Jesus makes his life completely different. I think of what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Even though there are people who resist that light change, even though there are people who don't want this the change that Jesus can do to life, I think of what Paul says when he talks about this idea of welcoming Jesus into life and welcoming the change that Jesus can bring to life. When he says, if anyone is in Christ, if anyone takes that step of putting Jesus on in baptism and making Jesus the Lord of their life, that person is a new creation. I think sometimes we don't realize that enough, that we don't really focus on what Paul's saying. That means you're a brand new thing. Jesus doesn't remodel. Jesus doesn't kind of take what you were and make it a little. He says, you're brand new. You start all over. The old is gone, Paul says. That's what Jesus gets to do for us. We use this idea of turning over a new leaf. That's a good metaphor, I get. But that's not, Jesus doesn't change the trajectory of our lives a little bit. Jesus doesn't tweak us. Jesus makes us new. That's what he did for this man. This wasn't a little better situation. This didn't help this guy out. This changed this man's life completely. And that's what Jesus does. That's what the light of Jesus does in the world. The Bible is full of examples of people who are just this. You think of Rahab. When we think of Rahab, I can't help but hear preachers my whole life refer to her as Rahab the harlot. I mean, that's just who she is. But that's not who she is. She's in the genealogy of Jesus because she was changed. You think of Moses. Moses, who has a connection with the people of Israel, then goes off after he murders someone, then comes back, gets this calling from God and says, God, you pick somebody else. I am not your guy. Then he leads a nation out of the strongest nation on earth at the time. You think of the apostles that Jesus called. These guys were fishermen. And Jesus changes their lives completely. Maybe no better example even than Paul the apostle. Or Saul of Tarsus. Who literally was there watching Christians be killed. That was his job, was to go get Christians and kill them. And later he writes, if anyone is in Christ, a new creation has come. Because that's who he was because of Jesus. He calls himself the chief of sinners. But he's also a new creation because of the light of Jesus that came into his life. We have to believe that Jesus can make a difference. How about you? I don't know any of you, basically. I don't know your spiritual situation, but I can imagine that there are several of you who can sit right here and are thinking right now, Jesus changed my life. I was this, whatever this is. Like I said, no matter where you were, even if you were a decent person, if you were without Christ, Jesus tells you you're lost. You're without hope, Paul says in Ephesians. Without Christ, you're without hope. Wherever, maybe you had some addiction. Maybe you had some deep struggle in your life before you came to Jesus. Then you've come to know who Jesus is. You made him the Lord of your life. And you're brand new. There's got to be somebody in here with that story because that's what Jesus does. So I want us to think. As we think about what Jesus did for this man, it may not be on the same scale. It probably isn't on the same scale. Assuming none of you were ever demon possessed. But whatever it is, without the grace of Jesus, you're just as lost, just as insane, just as deranged spiritually as this man was. Think about what God has done for you through Jesus. Think about the grace that God has shown to each of you. Doesn't that excite us? I'm telling you, that's one thing that I think, and maybe it's an Idaho thing. I'll tell you, we struggle with it. I think we forget how excited we should be about what God's done for us. Instead, we come to church, we're prim and proper, and we do the right things, and we don't sin. That's good. But why can't we be excited about what Jesus did for us? That's what we see next with this man. When we realize what Jesus has done for us, it ought to make us where we just cannot shut up about it. Look what happens here in the verses that were read for us a few minutes ago. Look at verses 19 and 20. We'll start at verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged him earnestly that he might remain with him. And here's the plot twist. This is kind of not what you expect, right? Jesus did not let him, but told him, "Go home to your own people and report to them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went out and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And look what happened. They were all amazed. Man, that is the Christian story in a nutshell, in three verses. What did Jesus do for you? You figure it out, you go tell somebody else, and people will be amazed. But that's too quick, and I've got more notes here, so I got to talk about that more. I can't just leave it like that. What happens when this man, he comes to Jesus, and like I said, what we would expect, he says, "Jesus, let me go with you." We expect Jesus to say, "Yes, come with me and I'll make you fishers of men," like we've seen him do. But that wasn't Jesus's point. His point wasn't to have a big crowd to follow him. His point wasn't to have a big posse to go with him everywhere. What Jesus wanted people to do was to go tell other people about what he's done. Jesus, in essence, tells this man, "No, don't come with me. You go home and you start telling people what Jesus has done in your life. You go home and you start sharing the gospel." So when we think of this idea, we think of this idea of what Jesus calls us to do and what we see with this man when he says, "No, don't come with me. I want you to go share this." I want us to look at four ideas really quick that I think we can apply to our own lives from what we see with this man. Because when we think about this idea of letting our light shine, again, I don't know y'all, but I can imagine there's probably somebody sitting there thinking, "Yeah, we need to let our light shine. That's why we have three paid guys to do it." Careful. But we think that, you know, that, okay, yeah, there's somebody should be doing that. Not me, but somebody should be doing that. When we look at this man, I want us to think about four different things. Number one, you don't have to be trained. Now, I'm a school of preaching guy. I'm finishing up a degree right now through another university. I believe in education. I believe in training. But look at this guy. This guy says, "Jesus, let me go with you." And Jesus says, "No, I don't want you to come with me. What I want you to do is I want you to go to a Christian college. After that, I want you to go to a school of preaching. And after that, I want you to probably be so bored and tired of learning that you don't..." No, that's not what happened. Jesus says, "No, just go tell people." He doesn't. And listen, I believe in preparation. I support schools of preaching. I support Christian education. That's all valuable. But it's not absolute either. Most of you in this room can speak. That's the requirement, right? And really, that's not even a requirement. If you can put it on paper, you do that. You can communicate. That's all you have to do. What did Jesus tell him to do? Go tell people what I did for you. I always ask people, can you tell people, can you tell me about, in Boise, Idaho, if you ask almost anyone with a pulse about the Boise State Broncos, just sit down and buckle up, because those people will talk BSU. You ask me about Oklahoma State, I'll bore you to death about Oklahoma State. You could almost any of you could probably tell somebody about when your first child was born. Most of you could tell about your first time you visited some great place, your favorite vacation, how to tie your shoes, how to ride a bike. Can you tell people what Jesus did for you? Just tell somebody. You don't have to have any special training, which is really leads right to the next idea. You don't have to know all the answers. How many answers did this guy know? You think this guy knew what the wheel within a wheel in Ezekiel was all about? You think he knew what Revelation was about? He didn't know about it. It hadn't even been written yet, so he couldn't know that. But you don't have to know all the answers. Too often we use that as our defense mechanism to say, well, you know, I don't know my Bible all that great, so I just don't want to talk to people. Okay, number one, solve that problem. Get to know your Bible better is the other thing. But you don't have to know all the answers. This man didn't know. You know what answer, the question he knew the answer to? What did Jesus do for you? He knew that answer. And he was willing to tell people that answer. If you don't understand prophecy, if you don't understand some things about the Holy Spirit, that's okay. Work on it. Figure it out. But you don't have to share with people stuff you don't know. If people ask you questions you don't know, just tell them, hey, I don't know that, but I'll connect you with somebody who can help us. But for right now, let me tell you what Jesus did for me. That's the only answer you need to know to get started. You don't have to be successful. You don't have to be a person of great reputation. I've heard so many people say, you know, well, I work a lot with our young adults, our young families back at home. And I've had some of them tell, you know, when we're done raising our kids, when I've advanced in my career, then we're really going to get active in church. But, you know, we're so focused on this or that right now. Again, you know, I want to take those people and say, well, let's go look at Mark chapter 5. You think this guy was considered successful or a man of great reputation? Dude just put on clothes for the first time in a while. I mean, that's square one. And he's telling people about Jesus. You don't have to have everything together in your life. You've all heard people say, I'm too bad to go to church. You know, if I walk in a church building, walls will fall. That's crazy. That's an excuse. And it's the same thing for us. When we say, you know, I don't know enough. I don't have the answers. I'm trying to do this or that in my life before I tell people about Jesus. Are you serious? This man was chained the day before, was cutting himself with rocks 15 minutes ago. Now he's telling people in the Decapolis about Jesus. You don't have to be successful. You don't have to have it all together before you tell people what Jesus has done in your life. And the last thing isn't a don't. But we have to remember Jesus says go, not come. Now, let me clarify this. Jesus does call us. He says, come follow me. We get that. That's big picture. And Jesus does say, through his word, he says, we need to come together. We need to worship together. We need to assemble. When it's time for us to be together to assemble, we need to be here. And again, I can say this because I'm leaving in a few hours. You need to be here. I don't care if you don't like Bible class, be here anyway because somebody else needs you here. It's good for me to see you in Bible class, whether you listen or not, and you should listen. But if you don't like to come on Wednesday night, come anyway because it's good for you. Because Jesus says, come be together, come grow, come experience each other, come grow in your knowledge of Him. But ultimately, we have to, and we see it right here with this guy. Jesus says, you know what? You can't come with me right now. Because what does Jesus see? John tells us that Jesus knows the hearts of men. Jesus knows this dude's on fire. Jesus says, you know what? You don't need to be with me. You need to go into town. You need to go tell those people what I've done for you. And it's so great. That's exactly what Jesus says. Just go tell them what I did for you. So that's what Jesus tells us. Sometimes, yes, we have to come together, but we have to remember our objective is go. Go into all the world. Go into Palm Beach County. Go into your neighborhood, in your school. Go tell people what Jesus has done for you. And I'll tell you this too. I always encourage people to figure out what your story is. Figure out what your Jesus story is. I mean, for me, I'll tell you, I was baptized as a young kid, as I was kind of a punk very, very early in life, and I knew it. And I told Josh yesterday, I told our youth minister, Judge Morris, when I was baptized into Christ in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma on July 11th, 1981, I came out of the water and I told Judge, I was like, y'all better change that water because you shouldn't put anybody else in that water. And I was a kid and I knew, maybe I had a vision of what was coming. I don't know. But I tell people, I was faithful for a long time. And then, you know, I was one of those seeds that kind of got choked by the world. And I was a bad kid. I was in trouble. I did a lot of stupid stuff. And then something clicked in my head when I realized it's time for me to fix my life. And God dropped Kara Bell into my life. I put off trying to meet this girl, my sister trying to set me up with my wife, who's now my wife. And I wouldn't do it. And at some point, it just clicked into place. And that was a life changer. And it was because of what, it's because I had a background, because I had been rooted in who Jesus is. But there was something that drew me back to who Jesus was. I had a lot of good influences. I had a lot of good friends that would call me and see me out at places and say, how come you don't come to church? How come we don't ever see you? And I let Jesus have control of my life again. We need to have our Jesus story. We need to tell people, here's what Jesus did. It took me from a place where I wasn't sure what life was going to do to me, and I won't give you a lot of details because it's just embarrassing. But when I finally allowed Jesus to be the Lord of my life again, He changed my life completely and made it better and gave me a beautiful wife that I do not deserve and kids that I think I do deserve sometimes. But know your Jesus story. So when people ask you, hey, what's the deal with your... You can tell them. And I'll tell you this. If you don't know it, you better rethink it. Because it may be I was baptized when I was a kid for whatever, I don't know. Rethink it. Because Jesus tells this guy, go and tell everybody you know what I've done for you. Anybody can do this. Anybody who has been touched by Jesus, anybody who has had Jesus make a difference in your life, and by the way, that's all of us. We can all do this. We can all be those who let our light shine in the world around us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 11, Paul says this, therefore, since we know the fear of the Lord, what do? We try to persuade people. That means we're begging and pleading with people. Since we know the fear of the Lord, he's saying, because we know what God has done for us, we know what Jesus can do for our lives, we know what ultimately awaits those who don't bow the knee to Jesus, and that's a harsh reality too, but we have to be real about that. But we persuade people. We shine our light so people can see Jesus in us. Then in verse 20, he says, therefore, we're ambassadors for Christ. Since God is making his appeal through us, we plead on Christ's behalf. Be reconciled to God. And then he says, the reason we do that is because God made Christ sin on our behalf so we could be his righteousness. We've already seen this idea of the light of the world and the city on a hill and the salt of the earth. We have to remember that as light, as salt, that means that we're ambassadors. That means that we're representatives to the world around us to let them see the light of Jesus. Because we know that's just exactly what they need. God's given us a job to do. And that job is that we shine His light. And we shine His light so that people may see our good works and give glory to our Father who is in heaven. That's a hard job. It's a hard thing to do. You may say, listen, people don't want to listen. People don't want to know this. And you're probably absolutely right, but you are not on your own. Jesus overcomes. And more than that, or not more than that, but along with that, you also have a body of believers by your side. This idea of this outreach thing, doing this together, that is so cool. You have to remember, you have a team of your own. You know, LeBron joined with that great team and made a greater team. We've got the greatest team there is in the body of Christ. It's a hard job to shine. But Jesus doesn't say do it on your own. He says, in Matthew 28 and 20, says, all authority has been given to me. And it says at the end of that, he says, lo, I am with you always to see us through this. You think about the impact Jesus made on this man's life. And you think about what Jesus told him to do. He told him to go to go tell people. Townspeople told Jesus to get out. They didn't like this whole idea. But apparently this man did his job. Because the next time we see Jesus in this region, there's 4,000 people waiting to be fed. One person can make a difference. One person. Maybe that one person is you. Maybe you're somebody who's outside of Christ right now. Maybe, like I said, I don't know y'all. Maybe you want to start in that relationship with Jesus. You want to be part of that light. Well, you can do that this morning. You can be immersed into Jesus. Have your sins forgiven. You'll be a new creation and start all over. We can help you with that this morning. Or maybe you're a Christian this morning and you know your light's not shining. You know you've kind of let your light, you put it under the bushel. No, like you're not supposed to. And that song told you that. And maybe you like the prayers of this body to help you shine your light again. Whatever your need is, this church family can help. We're going to stand and sing a song in just a minute. If you want to come up here, somebody can help you with that. Whatever you need, let this church family help you while we stand together and sing a song of encouragement.